it's customary to, for both haiku poets and Zen monks and nuns, to write a haiku right before death, expressing one's understanding, and as a last offering to those who are left behind. This poem was by Utsu, who died in spring during the cherry blossom season. The owner of the cherry blossoms turns to compost for the trees. The owner of the cherry blossoms turns to compost for the trees. This is by Kiko. That which blossoms falls, the way of all flesh in this world of flowers. That which blossoms falls, the way of all flesh in this world of flowers. It's really important as we do this practice that we are connected to our aspiration. And that our aspiration in the practice is clear, and that the methods we undertake and the way in which we undertake them match that aspiration. So I'd like to look at that from a few different angles. So first of all, what do you want from this? What do you want from this? What are you motivated by? What result would you like to see manifest? Now forget about the trope of no gain, no seeking. What do you want from this? What are you motivated by? Of course, this motivation particular image we have is going to evolve. But what is it you're after? Is it emotional resilience? Is it a calm body and mind? Do you want self-understanding? Are you seeking a transformation of your character? There are practices specific to all of these different things I mentioned. You can find someone to teach you the method and to guide you in its application. What do you want from this? What has brought you and keeps bringing you back to the cushion besides some kind of vague obligation? Do you want insight into selflessness? Insight into emptiness? Not does someone else tell you you should want it, or that that's some high good thing, but do you want insight into selflessness, into emptiness? Do you want a reliable experience of samadhi, a concentrated mind? Do you want a consistent experience of non-dual awareness? Are you compelled to have direct experience of the mystery? Are you compelled to bring about the cessation of suffering? There are practices specific for each of these things I mentioned. You can find someone to teach you this method and guide you in its application. What do you want from this? And if you don't have an answer come to mind, that's okay. The question might be useful. What is motivating you? What result do you envision or hope will manifest? As a bit of an aside, I wouldn't first knock on a poet's door to help me with my calculus homework. Of course, with student mind, everything can teach us, and yet, if I really want to learn to dance, keeping company with dancers is probably a good idea. So it's not wrong, bad, or unspiritual to have a clear sense of what you want from this. What does it reveal if we are afraid to look honestly at our motivation? There shouldn't be anything to lose, because what is true endures an honest eye. What is true or worthy endures awareness. Let me take a slightly different angle. What's your secret longing propelling you to do this practice? Is there a semi-conscious strategy? Is there a subtle image or ideal you are hoping will come to fruition? Do you hope through this practice to not have your conditions, to not have your personality? Is there some secret longing that instead of a tulip, you will become a rose? Or instead of a rose, you will become a tulip? Is there a secret wish that you will be the one who succeeds in transcending the human condition and leaps out of the life of the heart? Is there some secret wish to actually go numb? To live a less vibrant existence, to tamp things down and be safe. Do we think that by going through the motions, donning beads and a beatific grin, that we will not have to open up our box of darkness? Or that we could hide it from others? A secret hope that we'll get calm or good enough and that this box of darkness will quietly slip away. I want to share with you an opinion of Dogen Zenji that you might find challenging. I do. I often find myself in argument with him. And I don't read it because I think it's higher or correct. I read it because I like to consider the various views of those who have gone before. I like it as a ballast to my tendency to self-deception. Now, either way, when a teaching is challenging or irritating, that's useful. But maybe we're just irked by something we hear because we have a superior vantage point. And we can have that vantage point. And maybe, on the other hand, if we let it land, it will be like a grain of sand that eventually manifests a smooth, perfect pearl. through a long irritation that somehow you can't walk away from. So this is from an essay I find very irritating called Gakudo Yojinshu, Guidelines for Studying the Way. And I've heard that for new trainees in the Soto Monastery, this is the one text of Dogen that they thought they could actually work with. This section is titled, You Should Not Practice Buddha's Teaching with the Idea of Gain. The practice of Buddha's teaching is always done by receiving the essential instructions of a master, not by following your own ideas. In fact, Buddha's teaching cannot be attained by having ideas or not having ideas. Only when the mind of pure practice coincides with the way will body and mind be calm. If body and mind are not yet calm, they will not be at ease. When body and mind are not at ease, thorns grow on the path of realization. So that pure practice and the way coincide, how should we proceed? Proceed with the mind which neither grasps nor rejects, the mind unconcerned with name or gain. So name meaning a reputation, being known as good or great, or avoiding being called bad or no good. And gain, not just a really good meal or nice shiny or yoki bowls, the mind unconcerned with results from the practice. Proceed with the mind which neither grasps nor rejects, the mind unconcerned with name or gain. And here's a kicker. Do not practice Buddha Dharma with the thought that it is to benefit others. People in the present world, even those practicing the Buddha Dharma, have a mind which is far apart from the way. They practice what others praise and admire, even though they know it does not accord with the way. They reject and do not practice what others fail to honor and praise, even though they know it is the true way. How painful. You should try to quiet your mind and investigate whether these attitudes are Buddha Dharma or not. Clearly, Buddha Dharma is not practiced for one's own sake, and even less for the sake of fame and profit. Clearly, Buddha Dharma is not practiced for one's own sake, and even less for the sake of fame and profit. Just for the sake of Buddha Dharma, you should practice it. All Buddha's compassion and sympathy for sentient beings are neither for their own sake nor for others. It is just the nature of Buddha Dharma. Students, do not practice Buddha Dharma for your own sake. Do not practice Buddha Dharma for name and gain. Do not practice Buddha Dharma to attain blissful reward. Do not practice Buddha Dharma to attain miraculous effects. Practice Buddha Dharma solely for the sake of Buddha Dharma. This is the way. So all the various teachings we hear are good to let rest in the mind without rejecting them, without getting tangled up in them, but to let them float in the heart for a bit without trying to come to a conclusion. if we have a view that practice is a tool to wield on the world or ourselves, what's the consequence of that? It may be a very unusual way of understanding contemplative practice, that it's some sort of instrument to bring about a particular end. If we have a view that practice is a tool to wield on ourselves, what's the effect of that? If we have a view that ourselves, the world, and the practice are three different things, what's the consequence? Elsewhere, Dogen Zenji says, the way practices the way and is hindered by the way. That's exquisitely intimate. The way practices the way and is hindered by the way. He says, when you leave the way to the way, you attain the way. Here's something I have difficulty articulating. Have you ever been struck by the fact that you can't get out of this moment? You can't do anything about this moment. There is no leaping clear of what you are. It has impact to notice that. You are not on the outside looking at the moment. You're not on the inside with all this assorted stuff out there around you, like a hub and its spokes. And you're not somewhere in between. Where do you find yourself? There are some interesting but too easily misunderstood teachings in the Mahayana scriptures that say things like, devils are the birthplace of Buddhas, or affliction is Bodhi. Affliction, the afflictive emotions are awakening. Every morning we say emptiness, mental formations, consciousness, perceptions. Emptiness, no other than form. When you're fully hindered, you go beyond hindrance. You can't get out of being this moment. When you don't separate from this very time, there is no time. Everyone can testify that when you're immersed in your zazen, the period flies by. And when you're struggling like a snake in a bamboo tube, it's a very long period. There are many moments between now and the bell. When you're fully hindered, you go beyond hindrance. Have you ever noticed how tenacious the habit is of popping out to be a spectator of your own experience? There's almost a kind of voyeurism. And in a way, it's tiresome. the unending commentary on experience. You let that go for a moment, and then if we are always knowing in the reflective, discursive mode, we can't know intrinsic knowing. We don't appreciate that the way is hindered by the way. This practice, this very intimate, this so personal endeavor, it's not advancing or retreating. It's not transcending or suffering. It's neither surrender nor striving. And so Dogen says, you leave the way to the way and attain the way. I want to share with you a story about the way. So here's the story. It's called Seven Wise Women in the Charnel Ground. And it comes down from China, 9th century. Seven wise sisters planned a spring journey. Seven wise sisters planned a spring journey. Why not enjoy the beauty of the spring? One of them said, "Sisters, instead of going to a park to enjoy the spring flowers, let's go together to see the charnel grounds." How about that as a way to celebrate the first blossoms? "Sisters, instead of going to a park to enjoy the spring flowers, let's go together to see the charnel grounds." A few years ago, I was in Japan at cherry blossom season, and I was in Kyoto, and in the center of the city, there's a place called the Imperial Palace Grounds, and there are cherry blossom trees that are magnificent and centuries old that the people have cared for, and they were fortunate that some of them weren't destroyed in World War II. And the people from all over Japan get on trains and buses to come and picnic and look at these cherry blossom trees. Well, these ladies said, instead of doing that, let's go to the charnel grounds. So charnel grounds, if you don't know this term, are places where bodies are left to decompose, just left in the open, in certain kinds of forests. In Tibet, they put them on plateaus so that the birds can recycle them. And traditionally, this was a yogi or a yogini's practice place. "Let's go together to see the charnel grounds." The other sister said, "That place is full of decaying corpses." What is such a place good for? Flowers smell nice. Gardens have a fresh energy. But what is the mind that doesn't always seek to manicure reality? How aware are you of the comfort compass? That when there's a fork in the road, always the more comfortable option is the instinct. In a way, all organisms have this drive. But what about the mind that doesn't seek to manicure or avoid reality? How is it that we come to look courageously upon the harsh facts? What takes somebody into the medical profession, for example, or into prisons, or into hospice work? So in this Zendo, are we here decaying or evolving? Is this body a flower bed, a compost heap, both, neither? That place is filled with decaying corpses. What is such a place good for? The first woman replied, "Let's just go. Very good things are there." When they arrived, one of them pointed to a corpse and said, "There is a person's body. Where has the person gone?" There is a person's body. Where has the person's gone? Don't mistake this for naivete. This is a mind ripened in the great matter. There is a person's body. Where has the person gone? And the eldest sister said, "What? What did you say?" And all seven sisters had realization. It may be difficult to appreciate long staying in the heat of a deep question. I think back again to the instant download culture, the knowledge at your fingertips conditioning. Difficult to appreciate, even to grok the logic of long staying in the heat of a deep question. It's off the comfort map. You could say that everyone is in the heat of the same question. To be born is to be in the heat of the same question, and yet not being distracted from the specificity of it. Not being distracted by our boredom or our infatuation with novelty is the way. I know people who worked on one koan for over a decade. Are you willing to be with your question? Everybody has a question. Are you willing to be with your question for years? And if not, why not? And if not, what does that not willing to be with the question look like? How is that avoidance manifesting? There is a person's body. Where has the person gone? What is alive? the first and last of the deep questions. What is alive? What animates you? What hears this sound? When you are numb and dull, where has the person gone? When mind is still and body become translucent, where has the person gone? In sleep, you may not be you. Where has the person gone? Surely there are many sensations. Surely there are a myriad sensations in this moment. But what is the sensation of that which experiences them? I ask you to look. There is a person's body. Where has the person gone? The eldest sister said, "What? What did you say?" And all seven sisters had realization. Indra, the Lord of Gods, was moved by their awakening and showered flowers down upon them. He then offered them whatever they needed for the rest of their lives. One of the sisters replied, "But we have everything we need. We have everything we need." Was this true before the realization? Is it different after? Does that mean that hunger and desire are extinguished? Does it mean they change form? Indra, we have everything we need, but, she continued, please give us these three things. First, a tree without roots. Second, land with no light or shade. And third, a mountain valley where a shout does not echo. These were her three wishes: a tree without roots, land with no light or shade, a mountain valley where a shout does not echo. You could hold these in your heart. These are keys. These are doorways. Tree without roots, land with no light or shade, a mountain valley where a shout does not echo. They're all expressing the same thing. Indra said, "Ask anything else, holy ladies, but I don't have those things to give you." These are lines of great significance. "Ask anything else, holy ladies, but I don't have these things to give you." And the eldest sister said, "If you don't have them, how can you help others liberate themselves? If you don't have them, how can you help others liberate themselves?" We are fully endowed buds of the Dharma. Each of us blessed with the mystery of liveliness. And yet there is blooming to do. And yet there is flowering. I end with the poem that I read earlier in this week by Xingang. "This floating life an ever-changing dream. That's a statement of great joy. How are you hearing it? That's a statement of great joy. This floating life, an ever-changing dream, yet we bitterly toil away, the entire day full of busyness as our karma grinds us down. If only you can make a clean sweep of the cave of ignorance, you will be left with a life full of freedom and ease. Human life and this mirage of a world are kept going by craving. Once craving stops, all is the realm of the great enlightened one. The lords of the heavens and hells will find themselves speechless, having poked through the web. There will be no conditions of desire. The mind always composed and calm, that is the original purity. The mind always composed and calm, that is the original purity. Mere accumulation of facts, turbid worldly emotions. If you immediately change your life and step on to the further shore, your ignorance will shatter on its own with a laugh and a song. Understand the original mind and realize one is naturally complete. Ask urgently who you were before your father and mother were born. When you have seen through the method that underlies them all, the mountain blossoms and flowing streams rejoice with you.